Station number 12246, Lieutenant Colonel W.A. Waitman, Reel 10.
Colonel W.A. Waitman, Reel 10. What happened next, Colonel?
In the first fortnight of February 1945, 19th Indian Division had crossed the Irrawaddy to the north of Mandalay, one of their main bridgeheads being opposite Thabakin, and the 20th Indian Division had forced a crossing of the Irrawaddy opposite a small riverbank town of Mayin Mew. We had been given a very good study period on river crossings by Colonel Stocker, CO of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, whilst at Hallador to the whole brigade, and we were now ourselves preparing for our own crossing, which was to be to the west of Nat Kiang and Agata Yaw. So on the night of the 24th, 25th of February, the 5th Indian Infantry Brigade of 2 Div, two battalions, the Dorsets and the Worcesters, moving in ducks and craft with outboard motors, left the north bank of the Irrawaddy in the Dawiti Mayinzi village area, moving out of a chong or wadi across the river at two separate points, the Dorsets being just the west of Nagazun, Ngazun, on the Japanese-held bank of the river, and the Worcesters further downstream to the west of them. Now, the Irrawaddy is three times the width of the Rhine, and it was a considerable crossing, particularly against opposition. Unfortunately, the Worcesters hit heavy opposition on the south bank and had to abandon the river crossing. The Dorsets got a foothold. Then, ingeniously, the combined efforts of sappers and the 3rd Carbineers and Royal Army Service Corps personnel, this three-way effort, got tanks ashore, a troop of tanks, and eventually a squadron ashore on the south bank by putting a piece of Bailey Bridge between two of the ducks, the amphibian vehicles of the Royal Army Service Corps, and a bulldozer bulldozed a track from the riverbank up into the long grass, which in times of monsoon would obviously be covered with water and flooded, but being sand was easily bulldozable, and got first of all tanks ashore one at a time, and over a two-day period got the whole squadron across. We ourselves, 2DLI, made a night march as a battalion from Nat Kiang, where C Company had been covering the brigade, 6th Brigade headquarters, Agata Yaw, and we finished up at daylight just outside the village of Minzi, M-Y-I-N-Z-E. Then we set about preparing for the actual river crossing ourselves. And on the 26th of February, a heavy airstrike was put in on Nagazun by 24 medium bombers of the United States Air Force. It obviously rained bombs on this large village, and the Dorsets put in an attack and captured it under the command of Colonel O.G.W. White, DSO, Knocker White, previous Army hurdles champion. As we crossed the river, we saw Nagazun going up in flames and smoke, and Private Cook from Siem Harbour, with a bit of Geordie wit, said, "Somebody's Tommy Cook has gotten the better of him over there." We quickly to bust from the duck on the south bank. And on the way across, we had experienced desultory shelling from Japanese artillery on the south bank, dropping shells into the river, but fortunately not very close to us, and going off with quite a smacking sound, smack, as the shell hit the water and exploded. But, say, quite some distance away from us, so it was of more interest and not very fearsome. We then moved forward in the long grass and dug in. The rest of the battalion followed, and the whole battalion was across by the afternoon of the 26th of February. We mounted our normal stag, sentries in the three positions, relieving every 2 hours, and settled down for the night. That night, we were shelled, but again, nobody lost much sleep because the shells were landing in the soft sand and the long grass, and the battalion experienced no casualties because we were well spread out along the south bank of the river. About 200 yards in the Japanese held ground of the south bank, and beyond us was a line of trees. We stood to the next morning and were briefed that the battalion would be advancing due south with the Royal Berkshires on our left to capture the village of Nyaungwin, and we were to capture a ridge line about a mile and a half to our south beyond the trees, and we would have a troop of tanks with us to help us. The Berkshires would have a troop of tanks, and they would have an airstrike on the village of Nyaungwin. As we shook ourselves awake just before first light, poor Private Joss Jennings from South Shields let out a very obscene exclamation, "Bugger me, I've had a wet dream." It was to be his last bit of pleasure on God's earth, because he'd be killed before the day was over. The battalion was deployed two companies up. C Company left under Major Tony Shuttle, D Company right. Our company itself was two up, number 11 platoon left under Kit Corner, and myself commanding 10 platoon on the right, with company headquarters behind us and 9 platoon under Jack Dyer to the rear. And we moved out from the tree line onto a large, open, flat paddy field area. It was a memorable sight, with the Royal Berkshires advancing two up on the left, ourselves on the right of this brigade two-battalion attack. And to me, we resembled rather like a large number of Britain's lead soldiers advancing across a display in Hamleys of Regent Street. In a way, the paddy field, huge area of about a mile to our front and stretching several miles left and right, was like an ultra-large snooker table. And the British infantry going forward with rifles at the high port, bayonet fixed. We came under artillery fire as soon as we left the tree line. But again, it wasn't thick and was quite desultory. The further we advanced, the shells went whooshing over the top of us quite high, and looking back half a mile to the rear, I could see clouds of dust go in the air, the shell exploded, chaps laid flat on the paddy field, but no one apparently killed or injured. A sharp crackle of Japanese rifle fire rang out, very noticeable. The Japanese .256 Major rifle fire, very sharp crack, and D Company were in action. And we heard Bren and Sten firing, and some wag said, "I'll bet that Sten gun's Jimmy Schrapel." Colonel Tank Waterhouse had taken command of the battalion out the Banana Grove just over the Mew River at Yeo, and was still a major at this time. He'd actually taken command of the battalion when Colonel Brown was killed at Kohima. He won an MC himself, and being built like a tank, was affectionately known in the battalion and throughout the brigade and division as Major Tanky. Stuart Waterhouse, and also a native of Sunderland, a contemporary of my older brothers and sisters. The colonel left D Company to sort out the Japs in this palm tree area and moved B Company up on our right and ordered us to continue the advance. So we gradually closed in on Sandy Ridge. It was unnamed on the map, but we gave it that name. And as the paddy ended, so cotton patches and scrub arose going up the gentle forward slope of this sandy ridge. And on our left, we saw Hurricanes bombing with 500-pound bombs and strafing down Gwynne and the Berkshires going in by bounds and rushing various features and positions, and some blazing huts way over on our left. As we got to the cotton patch and the scrub on our right, and the ridge itself was loosely covered in the scrub, we saw for the first time ever Japanese running away, and about three or four of them were legging it in front of us. I opened fire on them, and whilst I was a reasonable shot on the range, I didn't see any collapsing in a heap or falling, but I was having an absolute field day banging away at these chaps as they nipped in and out of the scrub. Someone was obviously firing at us because I could hear bullets going past me. Crack, crack, crack. It's always said that you don't hear the one that hits you. McGrath, Charlie McGrath, the Major's batman, was behind me. He followed me, the Major being further back with company headquarters, and I had my two sections up, and one behind me and the platoon headquarters behind me. McGrath realised that I was being shot at more than I realised, and whilst I was enjoying myself potting at these nips, I could hear him saying, "Get down, sir, get down, sir. You'll get killed. Get down, sir. You'll get killed." In the end, he lost his patience and said, "Get down, you bloody fool. You'll get killed." I didn't take a blind bit of notice because we appeared to be pushing the nips back. And as I said earlier, it was the first time I'd ever seen them bolt. I then ordered charge and set off up the forward slope. On the left, the firing was going on in the 11th platoon area, and I heard Corporal Potts commanding the section, the right-hand section of 11th platoon, which was on my immediate left, shout, "Get forward the Bren." No one moved. He then shouted, "Right, come on," and set off on his own. Fortunately for him, he ran diagonally from his platoon axis towards my platoon axis, and he and I were due to meet about 70 or 80 yards further on. And as I ran up the slope, I expected my lads to be behind me. I learnt later that one of my section commanders had said, "Come on, lads, there's only one man in this battle. Let's give him a hand." And they came at a steady double up behind me. Ahead of me, I suddenly saw about 25 yards, 20 to 30 yards to my front, a Japanese pack in the hedgerow with Jap patrol boots tied on the back. And immediately flashed through my mind, "Good, I'll get a flag out of that one." However, suddenly, in front of the pack, up popped a Japanese head and shoulders, and the right arm of the individual concerned threw a grenade at me. I saw it coming, curving to me, with the smoke coming out of it from the fuse. I continued my forward advance and flung myself forward. The grenade curled past me, and I presumably it exploded to my rear. But with all the firing going on to the left and the right, including one of the carbineer's tanks of the troop of three that were with us, I never actually heard it go off. The Japanese had disappeared from sight, ducked down in his hole, but his rifle muzzle was still sticking over the top vertically. And I could hear a smacking sound, which I couldn't identify. I realised later, the next day, that the sound I could hear was the chap's wrist smacking into his own thigh and body, because he was such a tight fit in the hole, he couldn't get the bolt back to reload. I knew I couldn't guarantee hitting his round foxhole position with a 36 mils splinter grenade. I would get the full whack. And I tried to get my phosphorus bomb out, but unfortunately there were 2 mils grenades on top of it. So I fired and split the woodwork on the Jap's rifle. Had he popped up, I'd have nailed him. While this was happening in a matter of seconds, Corporal Potts was running in from the left, as I say, diagonally across me. I was on one knee. He was stood up, got a good view of the Jap, gave him 2 short, sharp bursts, and you could actually hear the bullets hitting his body, and the rifle stopped being jerked from side to side. Whereupon, having just done that, Potsy shouted, "Look out," flung himself flat, and a grenade came curling round the corner after him and exploded on our left without hitting either of us. So we realised there was another nip up the right angle of the hedge leading towards the top of the ridge. I then decided, because I could see a tank to the rear, that if I got the tank up, he could probably either machine gun him out of it or run him down. As I turned to go back for the tank, the major came up and I said, "Corporal Potts has got this one, but there's another one round the corner." He said, "Well, get a section and winkle him out." And I turned to the major and said, "Hang on, I've lost nobody yet. If we rush him, he'll definitely get one of us. If I get that tank behind, it'll do the trick." He said, "Right, carry on." So I doubled back down the slope, gentle slope, some 80 or 100 yards, to this Sherman tank. And in fact, whilst it was a Sherman tank, it had no main armament, and it was the forward observation officer, a Royal Artillery captain, for the self-propelled priest gun battery, which the division had. And I said, "There's a chap up this right angle, bang in front of us, as the hedge runs straight up the slope to the top of the ridge. Will you take him out for us?" He pointed to the drain pipe, which was simulating the main armament of the turret. And I said, "No, use your tracks, crush him." So he agreed to do this. The Captain Royal Artillery Forward Observation Officer agreed to run the over the Jap position with his tracks. I therefore doubled straight back to my platoon and lay behind this hedge where Corporal Potts had taken out the Jap who'd thrown the grenade at me. While we were waiting a few minutes for the tank to come up, Sherman tank to come up to us, we saw the troop of the carbineers on our right supporting B Company and the left hand tank of the troop trundling forward, fired at 75mm main armament directly into a Jap round foxhole. We didn't actually see the target itself, but having heard the tremendous belt of the gun immediately thereafter, a Jap's body came straight out of the ground, rather like a jack-in-the-box or a firework, and spun through the air. And one of the Geordies on my right said, "Look at that fucking bloke." And I must say, it did look rather spectacular. The forward observation officer trundled forward with a Sherman and started to crush the hedge. We wriggled forward And I saw the Jap in the hedgerow prepare to get out of his foxhole and run. At least from the waist upwards, he was clearly visible. I took aim with my rifle, fired, and he dropped back down into the hole. So I'd obviously got him. We wriggled through the hedge. The tank stopped. The captain was bravely standing up in his turret, looking out. His Beezer machine gun was lowered, and he fired a squirt into the hole. I ran forward and shouted up to him amidst the roar of his engines, twin Chryslers, "Thanks for the help, but I think I got him first." The reply back was, "Yes, he's yours, I just made sure." The burst of machine gun fire had got him right through the head, and his badge of rank from the front of his cap was floating on his brains. We then spread out again and continued our advance up the ridge. Firing was going on quite heavily on our right with B Company and the troop of carbineers. From the left, there was no firing other than the Berkshires, half a mile on our left, attacking Nhaung Nguyen. When we reached the top of the ridge, my Batman Armitage ran up to him and said, "Mr. Corner wounded, is a Batman killed, sir?" So I realised that 11 platoon on the left would be then under the command of Sergeant Chota Merry, Chota meaning small, from Stanley County, Durham. And I hoped that Kit Corner wasn't too badly wounded, but was saddened to hear that Leach had been killed. We learnt later that Corner fell first, and that Leach was killed, running forward to pick him up and drag him out. We got on top of the ridge and went forward slightly over the crest. The reverse slope was further away. In fact, it merged with the higher ground and the village beyond, half a mile beyond of Zalokma. So we decided that that was the limit of our advance and clearing the Japanese positions. I was the furthest man forward in my platoon, and I turned to give orders to the section commanders, shouting, "Right, dig in here," when there was a and Private Lance Corporal Jennings' steel helmet flew off, his knees buckled, and backwards he went, shot dead clean as a whistle. As he fell backwards, a piece of his hair seemed to stand up on end, rather like the comb of a cock pheasant. And my immediate thoughts were, "They've shot poor Corporal Jennings, but doesn't he look like a cock pheasant dropping?" I then shouted to the men on my left, "Where the hell did that come from?" And nobody seemed to know precisely, because we were in scrub, some of which was burning through the tank fire, main armament shells. Lance Corporal Nixon from the left-hand section suddenly twigged that the Japanese marked their round foxholes, which were dug flush with the ground, the soil having been removed completely, so that you didn't actually see them till you got right bang close up to them, by which time it was often too late in the first instance, that they marked them with a piece of dry palm leaf spray. So we realised there was at least one Jap still on the position. I went back 30 yards to the nearest carbineer tank, hammered on the side, and the side door opened, and Captain Peter Cornerby spoke to me. I indicated the approximate position from where the shot had come from and asked him to stoke it up. He trundled forward and gave it a jolly good spraying with machine gun fire. Whilst Just prior to this happening, the major told me I should take over command of 11 platoon as well and use 11 platoon and my own 10 platoon to clear this last Jap and any others that might remain on the top of the ridge. We moved forward again, and an unknown Geordie voice shouted, "It's our rate, he's dead." That was followed immediately by a and the well-known voice of Private Charlie Husband, "Fuck me if he is, look at my bloody rifle." And there, sure enough, on the woodwork of the furniture was the slash mark of the bullet that a Jap had fired and forced to hit Charlie's rifle and not Charlie. So I went back to Peter Cornaby and asked him to use his main armament. Got all my men laid flat on the ground, lower than snakes, because you can hide behind a blade of grass or a pebble, I can assure you of that. And the sponson gunner opened up with his 75mm. He gave the ridge half a dozen or more rounds, probably six or eight rounds. I said, "Right, coming in again." And forward we went. Through the smoke, I thought I saw a Jap, fired at it, but in retrospectively, it was another big pack. But simultaneously as I did that, having immediately reloaded, there was a whacking great bang. I was hit by the shock wave, went flat on my bottom, and the rifle was blown out of my hands. I grabbed it again rather quickly, I can assure you. And I was told by the chaps on the left, who were downwind of the smoke, that a Jap had appeared to throw a box or something at me, which was presumably explosive, but that he must have got more than I did. Because as I went backwards onto my backside, I could see a trunk of a human being disappearing into the smoke in front of me. I thought that might be the last of the matter, but as I moved forward a few more paces in the smoke and burning scrub bushes, which were actually wild cherry bushes, Husband was beside me. Suddenly there was another crack, a grunt, and Husband dropped on his knees. Immediately, hearing the thump as the bullet struck him, thought it would probably have killed him, and I turned to nip back a few yards out of the line of fire myself. But as I turned, I saw that Husband was only on his knees. So I did a full 360 degrees, hooked my arm under his right shoulder, dragged him to his feet, and pulled him backwards out of the line of fire. As I did so, I said, "Are you all right, Charlie?" And Husband replied, "I was all right, sir." I said, "Where are you hit?" He said, "Right between the fucking shoulders." I then thrust him back in the direction of company headquarters and the stretcher bearers. As I did this, his best pal, Private Joe Davis from Wingate, ran up towards him and said, "Are you all right, Charlie?" He says, "I was all right, Joe." And the reply was typical Geordie, "Why, you jammy bastard." Knowing full well that Husband would be put on a tank after the action and trundled back to the river and eventually evacuated to a medical dressing station, casualty station, and back to India. I then ordered the chaps to dig in as we appeared to have cleared the position. I moved over to liaise with B Company, the left-hand platoon, to tie up our arcs of fire. On the way, I encountered Private Brown, who was an officer's batman in B Company, and he said, "There's one or two Jap dead round here, sir." And as I was walking over towards the platoon commander to tie up our respective arcs, we saw a Japanese bent down double in his round foxhole. Unfortunately for him, he moved, and I said, "Well, this one's still alive." Pulled a 36 grenade out, put it in the foxhole with him. There was a bang, and whilst I expected big things, it killed him, but there was nothing spectacular like the one that was hit with a 75mm, which he got all to himself about half an hour earlier. We then dug in and awaited last light. Not long after last light, there was a sound of a single rifle shot and a grenade exploding in my right-hand forward section. Shortly after that, I heard someone coming towards me. over a distance of 20 yards from my platoon headquarters positions to the front two sections, someone crawling along the ground. As they got nearer, I realised it was Corporal Bobby Lowe's, and he was escorting a wounded Private Smith. What had happened, three Japs from further in the scrub had come back to see what had happened to their comrades. Smith had a Bren gun and he could have cut them down, but he'd been absolutely mesmerised with fright. Corporal Gardner fired a single shot and missed. Corporal Inch had thrown a grenade. They obviously ducked down when the grenade was thrown in the direction of the Japanese, but Smith, paralysed with fright, was hit by a splinter above on the forehead, above one of probably his left or right eye. Shiner Harrison, my number one mortarman in the foxhole behind me, hearing our voices, albeit subdued, crawled forward a few yards to give a hand and to see what was happening. Smith suddenly shouted, "There's one!" and jumped in the foxhole, right on top of my runner, Cooper, who was trying to sleep in the corner, flung his arm.